in October 1944? Or what would the United States government say if some South American republic could close the Panama Canal? It was equally impossible for Russia to remain subject to Turkey, who could close the straits and hamper Russian imports and exports and even her defense. These were waterways used by the French and British to lay siege to Sevastopol during the Crimean War. The Germans controlled them during two world wars. A Soviet military presence would provide Stalin's largely landlocked empire with both security and unrestricted access to a global maritime route. Back in Washington, Acheson watched Stalin's actions with alarm. The Eastern Mediterranean marked the intersection of his fears of British retrenchment and Soviet advance. The president, he was relieved to see, grasped the threat. Briefing him in the Oval Office, surrounded by top military brass, the undersecretary was awed to see Truman take a great big map from his desk drawer and deliver a 10-minute lecture on the strategic importance of the region. Truman had a passion for maps. Maps adorned his old Senate office, which he had used to follow the war. After moving into the White House, he was a regular visitor to the highly secure map room, where movements of ships and armies were constantly updated with colored pins. Using them as props, he impressed many under him, such as Acheson, and Chief of Staff to the Commander-in-Chief Admiral William Leahy, with his autodidact's knowledge of geography and military history. With no hesitation, Truman told Acheson to inform the Soviet chargé d'affaires, an ambassadorial subordinate, of his full support for Turkish rights in the Straits and his intention to take any act of aggression to the Security Council. He backed it up by ordering a flotilla of military ships to the Mediterranean and, secretly, authorized plans for strategic air force operations in the region. Stalin, after his intelligence agents confirmed that Truman was prepared to fight for Turkey, dropped his demands on Ankara in late October 1946. The map meeting would be seminal in the political bonding between Truman and Acheson. In spite of Britain's weakening position and Stalin's provocations in 1946, Washington was caught unprepared by Britain's retrenchment in 1947. Stuck in a 19th-century diplomatic and military posture, the United States had neither a policy nor the immediate capacity for deterring a determined aggressor in a traditional British theater of imperial control. General Walter Bedell Smith, the newly appointed ambassador in Moscow, thought Turkey had little hope of independent survival unless it were assured of solid long-term American and British support. British retreat now was tantamount to opening three continents to Soviet penetration. Reinstalled in Washington teaching grand strategy at the National War College, Kennan feared the Soviets would underestimate U.S. determination to prevent their further encroachment in the region, believing it raised the odds of war. Acheson, who unlike Kennan held no theory of Soviet conduct, was alarmed by the brute cartography of it. To his mind, the Kremlin's efforts to establish naval bases in the Turkish Straits presaged domination of an enfeebled Turkey, to be followed by penetration into Greece and the whole Near and Middle East. The region would then be cut off from the Western world, encouraging the Russians to push on into India, from which British lines of passage would be cut. China would follow. 2 years prior, FDR's State Department had been critical of Britain's military support for the brutal Greek royalists in their fight against communist rebels. But the geopolitical landscape had since changed. Greece, American Ambassador Lincoln McVeigh reported, was in complete political, economic, and social disarray. Armed communist bands, he warned, would take over if the government collapsed. Mark Etheridge, the U.S. delegate to a U.N. commission investigating Greek border disputes, reported that the Soviets feel that Greece is a ripe plum waiting to fall into their hands in a few weeks. When London had been urging a coalition against the Soviet threat on the European continent, Washington was uninterested. Now that Washington was warming to the idea, London hadn't the means to participate. Acheson, who had fought pitched battles with the FDR Treasury over its efforts to unravel the British Empire financially, now scrambled to deal with the consequences of its success. It was a crisis, he believed, in some ways more formidable than the one described in the first chapter of Genesis. Dean Goodrum Acheson, son of an Episcopal bishop, had been born for this moment, a moment his political memoir would term the creation. His abiding admiration for the Pax Britannica had, until this point, been a nostalgic one, one that made him an awkward bystander at times during two tours with the FDR administration. At Treasury in the early 1930s, he could not abide the president's willful destruction of the gold standard, an inheritance from the last century. At State in the early 1940s, he condemned efforts to encourage Britain's imperial liquidation. Britain had, until Pearl Harbor, stood alone against Hitler, and its collaboration, he believed, would be needed to restore order after his defeat. Now that the ruinous effects of British insolvency were clear, Acheson became consumed with a sense of mission. As convinced of the need to resist Soviet expansion as he had been of the need to roll back Nazi expansion before it, he set out to initiate a new American order to carry out the resistance. He hoped that this time, the United States would not have to resort to arms. Acheson was no reflexive cold warrior. He sought détente over confrontation. In 1944, he supported extending debt forgiveness and reconstruction aid to Moscow. In November 1945, he gave a speech to the Soviet-American Friendship Society before thousands at Madison Square Garden in New York, proclaiming that "We understand and agree with the Soviet Union that to have friendly governments along her borders is essential both to the security of the Soviet Union and the peace of the world." In a January 1946 address, he called it absolutely unthinkable that we should fight Russia. The press needled him as Red Dean. But he had also been deeply distrustful of the Soviet leadership since its crushing of Polish independence in 1945. A distrust that turned to alarmed wariness after Stalin's belligerent February 1946 election speech at the Bolshoi Theater on the eve of the first post-war balloting for the Supreme Soviet, in which he painted a dark landscape of inevitable conflict with the capitalist West. Acheson thought Secretary of State Jimmy Burns too naively compromising in his dealings with him. The media began to take note of the shift in his posture. When the facts seemed to him to merit a change, as they did in the case of the Soviet Union, wrote James Reston of the New York Times, Acheson switched with the facts. When in January 1947 Marshall asked Acheson to stay on as his undersecretary and de facto chief of staff, he accepted, with the proviso, that he would return to private life on June 30th, hardly sufficient time to erect a new post-war diplomatic architecture. But the dangerous breach in Western defenses left by Britain's retrenchment left him in no doubt of his responsibility for doing so now. Eloquent and possessed of a lawyerly love of logic and detail, Acheson was an ideal complement to Marshall. Their relationship would become much like that between Alexander Hamilton and George Washington, never close, but each essential to the other's success. George Frost Kennan, too, was no instinctual cold warrior. 6 feet tall, thin, balding, with engaging blue eyes and a smile, chilling or charming as its owner decrees. An eclectic, emotional, even melancholic intellectual, Kennan had what at times seemed an all-consuming empathy for Russia. Fascinated by foreign peoples generally, or more specifically those living outside the United States, where he favored old stock Protestants such as himself, Kennan, whose great-uncle of the same name had traveled Russia and written popular books on Siberian life and Tsarist authoritarianism, had a powerful affinity for Russians. "It gave me an indescribable sort of satisfaction," he said after returning to Moscow in 1944, "to feel myself back again in the midst of these people, with their tremendous pulsating warmth and vitality. I sometimes feel that I would rather be sent to Siberia among them than to live on Park Avenue among our own stuffy folk." Deeper still was Kennan's love for the Russia of literary renderings, of Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, and Chekhov, of whom he was writing a biography, never finished. His facility with the language, buoyed as it was by his literary engagement with it, astonished Russians, even Stalin himself. Kennan's warm sentiments for the country and its culture, however, did not extend to its leadership. He abominated it. Like Acheson, he was unnerved by Moscow's brutal subjugation of liberated Poland after 1945, as he was by the massacre of thousands of Polish officers at Katyn 5 years prior. He saw these as harbingers of wider aggression to come. Kennan had two postings to the embassy in Moscow, the first from 1933, right after FDR normalized relations with the communist government, to 1937, and the second from 1944 to 1946. On May 9, 1945, he watched the city's frenzied celebration of the war's end from the embassy's balcony. Terrified of being swept away by the surging mass of revelers, he, as deputy chief of mission with Ambassador Harriman away, felt he had no choice but to engage them, lest silence be interpreted as official indifference or hostility. Walking downstairs and stepping out onto the pedestal of one of the building's large columns, he summoned his courage. "Congratulations on the day of victory," he shouted in Russian. "All honor to the Soviet allies." The crowd roared. Kennan, heart pounding, dashed back inside. Harriman, the former banker, pragmatic, peremptory, businesslike, monolingual. Kennan's temperamental and intellectual opposite had great regard for his deputy's insights, but was put off by his impractical tendency to ruminate. Kennan, he said, was a man who understood Russia but didn't understand the United States. Boland seemed to agree, urging his friend to reacquaint himself with his native land by automobile after returning from Moscow in May 1946. Kennan certainly did not understand his government, or more specifically, what he considered its absurd belief that it could conclude a grand alliance with Moscow to preside over a peaceful post-war world. In early 1946, he set out to disabuse Washington of its notions in the most famous and influential diplomatic cable in history, what has come to be known as the Long Telegram. Burns had asked for Kennan's analysis of Stalin's notorious election speech. What he got back on February 22nd was a 5,326-word cable, well exceeding the department's length limits, written in a singular style, mixing high prose with telegrammatic abbreviation, expounding on the forces driving the behavior of Soviet rulers. Kennan argued that the natural neuroses and insecurities of Russian autocrats were born of a geographic vulnerability to outside predators and found their ultimate political pretext in Marxist dogma. In this dogma, with its basic altruism of purpose, they found justification for their instinctive fear of the outside world, for the dictatorship without which they did not know how to rule, for cruelties they did not dare not to inflict, for sacrifice they felt bound to demand. In the name of Marxism, they sacrificed every single ethical value in their methods and tactics. Today they cannot dispense with it. It is the fig leaf of their moral and intellectual respectability. Without it, they would stand before history, at best, as only the last of that long succession of cruel and wasteful Russian rulers, who have relentlessly forced the country on to ever new heights of military power in order to guarantee the external security of their internally weak regimes. The implications for American policy were stark. "We have here," he wrote, "a political force committed fanatically to the belief that with the U.S. there can be no permanent modus vivendi, that it is desirable and necessary that the internal harmony of our society be disrupted, our traditional way of life be destroyed, the international authority of our state be broken, if Soviet power is to be secure." Negotiations with them were ultimately fruitless. Soviet leaders, he argued, were impervious to logic of reason. They were, however, highly sensitive to logic of force. As the content of the cable flowed through the Washington foreign policy apparatus, the effect was rapid, widespread, and consequential. The year 1946, Acheson would later write, was for the most part a year of learning that minds in the Kremlin worked very much as George F. Kennan had predicted they would. The rhetorical quality of the cable should not be underestimated. Kennan's prose had, in Acheson's words, a sort of sad, lyrical beauty about it which drugs the mind. Even if the Russia his cable purported to explain had been fictional, its sheer logical eloquence, not typically seen in such a medium, would have ensured an impact. It offered a sense of epiphany, of a great and important mystery being unraveled. It gave justification to inchoate animus. And the message seemed clear, devoid of the usual messy diplomatic caveats. Russia was implacably hostile to American interests, and had to be confronted whenever and wherever those interests were challenged. Even those, like future Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, who had been convinced that Marxism was driving Russian expansionism rather than being co-opted to justify it, as Kennan was arguing, embraced this message. Kennan would sharpen and expand upon it in an article he was now, in the spring of 1947, honing for the establishment journal Foreign Affairs, an article he would naively publish anonymously under the pseudonym X, but which would make its easily identifiable author famous. The piece would argue that the main element of any United States policy toward the Soviet Union must be that of a long-term, patient but firm and vigilant containment of Russian expansive tendencies. Such containment would have to be conducted through the adroit and vigilant application of counterforce at a series of constantly shifting geographical and political points. On the basis of the telegram and the article, Henry Kissinger would later credit Kennan with coming as close to authoring the diplomatic doctrine of his era as any diplomat in our history. But what did containment mean? When translating the article for Stalin, certain Soviet analysts wanted it hardened to strangulation. Though they were overruled, Stalin still interpreted containment as extremely hostile to the USSR. Given the context painted of an implacable foe, together with the reference to force, the article appeared to be pointing to armed confrontation. Indeed, Kennan's War College lectures in the fall would highlight the benefit in negotiations of quiet but effective augmentations of our military and air strength. Soviet leaders, he said, are not gamblers when faced with the reality of military force. But Kennan was never that simple. In two of the most important paragraphs of his cable, he insisted that a robust diplomatic offensive against Moscow needed to encompass what Harvard's Joseph Nye would today term soft power, being able to influence the behavior of others who might otherwise fall under Soviet influence. "We must," Kennan said, "put forward for other nations a much more positive and constructive picture of the sort of world we would like to see than we have put forward in the past." Europeans, he wrote, were tired and frightened by experiences of the past. They were seeking security, to be understood in the widest sense, encompassing domestic order, material well-being, and freedom from foreign threat. "We should," he went on, "be better able than the Russians to give them this." But if the United States failed to act, if it retreated into the old isolationism, the Russians certainly will act to fill the gap. Americans must never, however, Kennan emphasized, behave like Russians. "We must have the courage and self-confidence to cling to our own methods and conceptions of human society." It is no leap to read into these passages, however vague, a call for the United States to bolster free and independent European nations through material as well as military assistance, a prescription that lay ready for the first hard evidence of the malady. In early 1947, it was at hand. Kennan argued that Moscow would exploit all timely and promising opportunities to expand its power. Initially, it would focus on neighboring points of immediate strategic necessity, such as northern Iran and Turkey. The State Department, Special Assistant Joseph Jones explained, now saw these countries together with Greece as a single barrier to Russia, breaking through into the Middle East, South Asia, and North Africa. And given that every communist party in the world was, Bolin asserted, the subservient instrument of Moscow policy, the installation of a communist regime in Athens would have meant extension of Soviet control in the eastern Mediterranean. The upshot, Jones said, was that everyone in the executive branch now recognized what British abdication from the Middle East meant. That if Russian expansion was to be checked, the United States would have to move into the defaulted position in the Middle East. Such a move could not be taken without reckoning with its consequences. Soviet Foreign Minister Molotov had been blunt in condemning British political, economic, and military support for the royalists in Greece as unacceptable interference in that country's internal affairs and a threat to international peace and security. He had typically been more restrained in leveling charges against the United States, but any overt move by the Truman administration to take over the British role in Greece with financial and military aid would, at least many in Washington believed, elicit a harsh reaction from the Kremlin. Confining the boundaries of a confrontation to Greece seemed, therefore, a virtual impossibility at this point, whatever the two sides might wish for. Thus would begin what Jones was famously to call the 15 weeks, America's monumental breakneck transformation into a political superpower, filling the breach left by Britain's imperial implosion. Acheson's staff followed orders to work like hell over the weekend of February 22nd, 23rd, preparing reports on the political, military, and financial situations in Greece and Turkey, and position papers laying out the case for U.S. aid. Following a business-like tete-a-tete between Inverchapel and Marshall on Monday morning, the 24th, Acheson finally sat down with his new boss. The unflappable 66-year-old general had found Inverchapel's news unpleasant, but not wholly unexpected. Unafflicted by Acheson's Anglocentrism, Marshall would certainly have recoiled from his deputy's biblical analogies. The final collapse of the British Empire was, to him, a well-signaled event with regrettable but manageable consequences. He probed the practicalities. How long could the British be induced to keep troops in Greece? What forces would be necessary to replace them? How would the administration get an effective government going? What would it cost, and over what timetable? Acheson had no answers. Needing to prepare for a critical conference on Germany with his Soviet, British, and French counterparts next month in Moscow, Marshall directed Acheson to find them. Matters proceeded at breakneck speed. Following a lunch meeting with Truman and Marshall, War Secretary Robert Patterson and Navy Secretary James Forrestal agreed with Acheson on the central elements of the recommendations they would prepare for the president, that it was vital to the security of the United States that Greece and Turkey be strengthened so as to safeguard their independence, that only the United States could do this, and that Congress would need to provide the necessary authority and funds. On February 25th, Acheson met with state's top political, economic, legal, and information officers to hash out alternate courses of action and an initial draft of the department's position and recommendations paper. Perspectives differed over the prudence of challenging the Soviets so directly at that juncture. Whereas some were elated over the possibility that the United States might at last stand out boldly against Soviet expansion, others were concerned about doing so when American military strength was at a low ebb. The exchange was robust, if unnervingly compressed, given the enormity of the commitments being proposed. Acheson let the discussion range until it was time to deliver his summation, at which point he issued the inevitable directive, devise a plan for immediate financial and military aid to Greece and Turkey. Russia specialist Loy Henderson and the Near Eastern Affairs staff worked into the night drafting the final version of the recommendations, which Patterson and Forrestal approved the following day. But the backing came only after an intense discussion of whether similar aid was needed for South Korea, China, and other vulnerable countries and territories. Army Chief of Staff General Dwight Eisenhower wanted the study to be expanded with a view to making a wider appropriation request, though the group rejected a wider request as impractical, given the obstacles of time and Congress, the question of the geographic boundaries of the commitment to containing communism would not go away. Indeed, it would come to trouble Kennan and others who saw great dangers in the president issuing blanket guarantees to protect the globe from communists. Truman had his report that afternoon. Convinced since Potsdam that the communist police state was as great a threat as the Nazi one, he signed off. For the State Department, the military, and the president to coalesce in peacetime so rapidly around such a far-reaching, potentially open-ended American commitment abroad was unprecedented. The consciousness that a chapter in world history had come to an end, Jones observed, was so real and ever-present as to seem almost tangible to all involved. Yet the initiative still faced an enormous hurdle in the form of the Republican-controlled legislature. Truman, an accidental and politically isolated Democratic president, knew he needed to get them on board immediately. The White House telephoned invitations to the House and Senate leadership for a meeting at 10 the following morning. 8 congressmen, 4 Republican and 4 Democrat, joined Truman, Marshall, and Acheson at the White House on February 27. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Arthur Vandenberg, Republican, Michigan; Stiles Bridges, Republican, New Hampshire; Tom Connelly, Democrat, Texas; and Alvin Barkley, Democrat, Kentucky, represented the Senate. Speaker Joseph Martin, Republican, Massachusetts; Minority Leader Sam Rayburn, Democrat, Texas; Charles Eaton, Republican, New Jersey; and Saul Bloom, Democrat, New York, represented the House. Acheson eyed the scene around the circular table with foreboding. "I knew we were met at Armageddon," he reflected later, continuing to pile on the biblical references. Truman invited his new Secretary of State to explain why the group had been assembled at such hasty notice. Marshall, as was his practice in such settings, read from a prepared script. He flubbed it, at least according to Acheson. In Jones' word, Marshall was cryptic. He conveyed the impression that aid should be extended to Greece on grounds of loyalty and humanitarianism, and to Turkey to strengthen Britain's position in the Middle East, rather than to resist Soviet expansion. The congressional majority, committed as it was to cutting foreign aid and taxes, was in no mood for suggestions that it do the opposite without strong cause. Their leaders demanded to know why the United States should be pulling British chestnuts out of the fire, and how much it was all going to cost. When delivering unwelcome news, style is never separable from substance. Skepticism brooks no charity toward inept messengers. Marshall, a dry speaker, even in the most friendly of settings, had an aversion to tub-thumping rhetoric. Yet Jones' account is still curiously at odds with what Marshall actually said, which was that the country was faced with the first crisis of a series which might extend Soviet domination to Europe, the Middle East, and Asia. The words, at least, could hardly have been starker. But Jones was close to Acheson, whose portentously titled memoirs, Present at the Creation, declared, "This was my crisis. For a week I had nurtured it." Part of him may simply have wanted to reclaim it as his own. "Is this a private fight?" Acheson whispered to Marshall as the congressman grumbled. "Or can anyone get into it?" Marshall turned to Truman, asking him to give Acheson the floor. Truman agreed. Acheson was conscious of having one chance to reset the discussion. Failure to persuade the visitors would be fatal for the funding request. With a litigator's skill, a preacher's conviction, and a politician's feel for his moment in history, he laid out a narrative focused on the clear and present communist threat. Senators Vandenberg and Connolly, Acheson recalled to the group, had traveled with Secretary Burns from conference to conference in Europe, trying with tenacious goodwill to negotiate peace settlements. The Soviet Union, meanwhile, he said, busied itself encircling Germany, Turkey, Iran, and Greece, probing for opportunities to destabilize them. With the British pullback, Greece was, Acheson warned, at imminent risk of collapse. Unhindered by any organized resistance, the Soviets would take control, after which it was only a matter of time before Turkey succumbed. From Turkey, he said, the Eastern Mediterranean and Middle East would be open to them, after which penetration of South Asia and Africa was inevitable. All the while, Soviet-backed communist movements would continue to undermine Hungary, Austria, France, and Italy. Aiding Greece, Acheson insisted, had nothing to do with British chestnuts. Britain was finished. Its financial position was untenable. Only 2 great powers remained in the world, the United States and the Soviet Union, a polarization of global power unparalleled since the time of Rome and Carthage. The ideological chasm between the two was unbridgeable. democracy and individual liberty were antithetic to dictatorship and absolute conformity. The Soviet Union, which already spanned huge swaths of two continents, was determined to expand its control to two-thirds of the world's surface and three-quarters of its people. Aiding Greece and Turkey, therefore, was not about helping the British. It was not about humanitarianism. It was about supporting free peoples against communist aggression and subversion in the service of preserving America's national security. The choice, therefore, was whether to act with determination or lose by default. A pregnant silence followed. It was Vandenberg who broke it. He was, he said, greatly impressed, even shaken, by developments in the Mediterranean. Greece and Turkey, though, however serious their situations, were only part of a much bigger problem the United States needed to face. It was essential, therefore, that any request for funds and authority to act be accompanied by a message to Congress and an explanation to the American people about the grim facts of the larger situation. Greece, he would clarify to a colleague 6 days later, cannot be isolated by itself. On the contrary, it is probably symbolic of the worldwide ideological clash between Eastern communism and Western democracy, and it may easily be the thing which requires us to make some very fateful and far-reaching decisions. According to Henderson, who was present at the meeting with the congressional leaders, Vandenberg added that the president would have to scare the heck out of the country. But if he would have a go, the senator would back him. And I believe that most members will do the same. Truman pledged to set out his aid request for Greece and Turkey against the broader background and in the frankest terms. It was Vandenberg's condition, Jones concluded, that made it possible, even necessary, to launch the global policy that broke through the remaining barriers of American isolationism. News of the secret morning meeting spread, as of course did speculation as to its agenda and meaning. The administration now had to get out in front of the story. Acheson arranged for an off-the-record briefing with 20 newspaper correspondents that evening. In the New York Times, Reston hit all the notes Acheson needed Congress and the public to hear. Greece was at serious risk of falling to the Kremlin-backed communist insurgency. This was a critical point in terms of American policy toward Britain, an ally in grave financial circumstances, and the Soviet Union, expansion of whose power and influence the administration was committed to checking, a policy of stern containment. Reston noted that there was no enthusiasm on Capitol Hill for additional foreign loans, and little willingness to think through the broader implications of the British economic crisis on our foreign policy. Importantly, however, he concluded that few leading members of the majority Republican Party seem eager to take the responsibility for the consequences of rejecting the president's request for funds and authority. Such wariness could help soften the opposition the administration would face. The next morning, February 28th, Acheson assembled his key departmental officers in the secretary's conference room, explaining with unusual gravity the historic decisions that had been made over the preceding days, and laying out the work ahead. They would have to craft a presidential message explaining the global struggle between freedom and totalitarianism. He would have to stress, he said, in words that would have made Kennan shudder, the protection of democracy everywhere in the world. There were, however, clear tensions in Acheson's framing of the mission. On the one hand, staff were told to proceed vigorously without any regard to the effect that the Greece-Turkey program or any public statement of it might have on the Moscow conference or upon the secretary's personal position there. On the other, they were instructed not to be belligerent or provocative. The policy was not to be directed against any country or even movement. The latter might work as a statement of principle, but not a practical fact. The administration was only backing massive aid to Greece and Turkey because of the presumed intentions of one country, the Soviet Union. These tensions over how broadly Moscow would be confronted, and through what means, would bedevil two fateful initiatives that would emerge in the coming weeks and months, one a doctrine to be named for the president, and another a plan to be named for the Secretary of State. Each proposed sentence of the president's message to Congress was scrutinized from every angle: diplomatic, political, and stylistic. Numerous State Department and White House staff were involved. Truman himself criticized an early draft as too wordy and technical. The Missourian being a straight speaker, there was little room to hide ambiguities behind rhetorical flourish. "I wanted no hedging," Truman insisted. "It had to be clear and free of hesitation and double talk." Difficult and consequential decisions would therefore have to be made about what was said and what was not. "If FDR were alive, I think I know what he'd do," observed Acheson, a man who was without affection for the former president. "He would make a statement of global policy, but confine his request for money right now to Greece and Turkey." Jones revised accordingly. The president would ask for $400 million, $4.32 billion in today's money, to aid the two countries, and those two countries alone, through the first half of 1948. In the end, the speech would be far more Greece than Turkey, strikingly more, given the greater strategic importance of the latter. Turkey's location made it vital to the defense of the eastern Mediterranean and the security of nations on three continents. Military assistance to Ankara was considered imperative in private discussions between the executive branch and congressional leaders. Yet there was great reluctance to have the president highlighting this publicly. Turkey had not suffered the war destruction that Greece had, and was not in the midst of a domestic uprising. There was therefore an element of raw power diplomacy to Turkish aid that, it was feared, would alienate the American public. Turkey, moreover, unlike Greece, shared a border with the Soviet Union. Though the Soviet Union would, most strikingly, not be mentioned in the address, the State Department still feared that Moscow would make propaganda out of an American military aid initiative in Turkey that appeared to threaten it with Western encirclement. Turkey, one witness before the House Committee on Foreign Affairs observed wryly, was slipped into the oven with Greece because that seemed to be the surest way to cook a tough bird. Treatment of Great Britain was also cautious. The inability of Britain to continue aid to Greece and Turkey would be cited in each case as a reason why American aid was necessary. Yet no suggestion would be made that the United States was stepping directly into the breaches of a collapsing empire. FDR had been too forthright in highlighting the evils of empire for his accidental successor to appear to be creating one. The speech was anything but cautious, however, in pushing the boundaries of what Congress had previously considered prudent foreign economic policy. When bankrupt Britain had been holding the fort alone against Nazi Germany in 1941, Congress still demanded economic consideration for lend-lease aid, which was merely in the form of loans and not grants. When in 1945 Morgenthau and White fought to justify the Bretton Woods monetary and financial agreements before Congress, they were again touting only loans and not grants to revive the collapsed international trading system. That vision would be challenged by the new International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, IBRD, whose 1946-47 annual report observed, understatedly, that the problem of recovery is deeper and more difficult than was envisioned at Bretton Woods. Even just a few days before the president's address, Truman had delivered a major speech on foreign economic policy at Baylor University that, having been written largely before the Greek and Turkish crisis, went little beyond calling for reciprocal agreements to boost trade. Will Clayton, who had drafted much of it, wanted the president to stress the need for bolder economic measures than have ever been seriously advanced before, but was overruled. Nowhere in the Baylor speech was there a suggestion that the United States might need to intervene on its own in the internal economic affairs of other nations, to provide hundreds of millions of dollars in assistance and to direct their use, or that doing so might be necessary to their survival as independent nations, and even essential to American national security itself. It was a calculated political gamble for the president to take such a message to Congress. To be sure, the groundwork had been laid in advance through meetings with congressional leaders and briefings to the press. Vandenberg would himself urge Marshall to tell Stalin in Moscow that the United States would use economic intervention to block Soviet expansion. Still, when Truman assembled his cabinet on March 7th to review the crisis and the program he planned to put before Congress, the support they gave him was tempered by deep skepticism that a majority could be brought to assent. The Senate, after all, had just voted 3 days earlier to cut the president's budget for the coming fiscal year by $4.5 billion, and the House 15 days earlier by $6 billion. And as Truman himself noted, the commitment he was asking them to make had no fixed borders or timeline. "It means," he observed gravely, "that the United States is going into European politics with no clear plan to get out." Thus was the ground being laid for a radical change in aid policy, when they would place it in the service of frontline foreign policy. Previous large-scale assistance for war victim relief had been channeled through the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, UNRWA. Founded in 1943, UNRWA was mainly financed by the United States, but outside of its direct control. UNRWA's criteria for support were non-political. American support for UNRWA activities, however, had been steadily eroding, and was dealt a blow by two incidents in August 1946, in which U.S. C-47 transport planes were shot down while inadvertently passing over Yugoslav territory on their way from Austria to Italy. In the first incident, on August 9th, there were no fatalities, but officials in Belgrade initially denied U.S. consular access to the seven Americans. In the second, on the 19th, all five crew members were killed. Secretary of State Jimmy Burns was enraged. He directed Clayton to take whatever action necessary to stop further UNRWA shipments to Yugoslavia, 73% of whose relief assistance from the organization was being funded by the United States. He further demanded that when UNRWA expired, any new appropriations by Congress for foreign relief should be allocated by the United States and should go to those countries who would not denounce us for granting them the relief they asked for. This reflected not only his personal views, but the reality that UNRWA was now deeply unpopular in Congress. He suggested that it was countries like Greece and Turkey that should get American aid, rather than those who, either from helplessness or otherwise, are opposed to our principles. Half a year later, a new Secretary of State would have aid to these two states at the center of his department's agenda. The president's speech would therefore mark a radical break from FDR's vision of a United States acting on the world stage through the new United Nations. It would instead mark the first time a U.S. administration would justify a muscular course of unilateral action outside the UN, even though it would claim to do so in support of the organization's ends. It would also signal, Acheson said privately, that we are entering an adversary relationship with the Soviet Union. Ironically, the man whose ideas on the importance of containing Russia were most influential in framing the president's message was also the most critical high-level voice over both its content and tone. But George Kennan would make a career out of repeatedly testing his powers of persuasion and then recoiling from the consequences. Kennan backed economic aid to Greece, but, believing the Soviet threat remote, wanted to keep military aid to a minimum. He opposed any aid whatsoever to Turkey, which was successfully, he believed, resisting Soviet pressures on its own. He would temper this view 3 weeks later. By the summer, he would be back in covert operations in both countries. Even though the speech would not mention the Soviet Union, Kennan thought it dangerously confrontational. The emphasis on the irreconcilability of two ways of life, one free and one relying on terror and repression, combined with an unbounded American commitment to aid free peoples resisting attempted subjugation, might, he feared, even provoke the Russians to launch a war. Others, however, such as Forrestal, a hawk's hawk, felt that the United States had to make a show of power in Greece and Turkey to deter the Soviets from pressing forward elsewhere. White House counsel and speechwriter Clark Clifford agreed and wanted the message strengthened. It was time for the opening gun in the effort to awaken the American public to the dimensions of the Soviet threat. He did the final touch-ups to the president's address together with his aide, George Elsey, who had co-authored a dark and ominous 100,000-word analysis of American Relations with the Soviet Union the September prior. The Clifford Elsey Report, as it became known, had featured a call for the United States to support and assist democratic countries which are in any way menaced or endangered by the USSR. Truman had ordered all copies to be locked away at the time. It would blow the roof off the Kremlin, he said. But for such elements of the report, the time had come. The resulting speech, in Marshall's view, was too much rhetoric, or in Boland's reckoning, too much flamboyant anti-communism. In Acheson's view, though, it was sometimes necessary, when dealing with Congress, to make arguments clearer than the truth. The White House insisted the Senate would never approve such a sweeping new policy without a spotlight on the communist threat. Truman thought the first State Department draft too much like an investment prospectus. He wanted no hedge in this speech. It was to be America's answer to the surge of communist tyranny. The president himself rewrote the words, "I believe it should be the policy of the United States," as "I believe it must be the policy," making a doctrine out of a statement of belief. Kennan's apparent split with Elsie went much deeper than just concern over the speech's tone. He never bought into Acheson's rotten apple theory that one bad apple, grease, could spoil the barrel. But many of Acheson's colleagues echoed him. When revolution is successful in one country, Ambassador McVeigh argued, it is the doctrine of international communism to breed it into the next country. Greece and Turkey are a strategic line. If the communists break that down, the whole Near East falls. What Acheson described as rot spreading from apple to apple would later be captured by the image of falling dominoes, each knocking the next into the subsequent. Dominoes would become the metaphor of choice for Truman's successor Eisenhower, in reference to Indochina in 1954. Why were images of rotting apples and falling dominoes, typically offered with no reference to the politics, culture, topography, or indeed any specifics of the actual countries in question, as compelling as they were to those making the decisions? One answer lies in the rise of the discipline of geopolitics, as practiced through the analysis of maps and the spatial relations between their objects. Briton Halford Mackinder, arguably its founding father, had died only the day before the cabinet meeting approving Truman's speech proposal, on March 6. Mackinder, a man who thought in metaphors, had undergone several major political conversions in his career, all driven largely by epiphanies triggered by the study of maps. The focal point of his final one was the supposed strategic centrality of the vast Eurasian heartland, which was dominated by Russia. "Who rules East Europe," he famously wrote in 1919, "commands the heartland. Who rules the heartland commands the world island. Who rules the world island commands the world." The contiguous heartland surface mass looms threateningly large on a map, particularly when the map is centered on it and distorted by an oval presentation. In 1943, Mackinder wrote an influential piece in Foreign Affairs applying spatial analysis, arguing that if the Soviet Union emerges from the war as conqueror of Germany, she must rank as the greatest land power on the globe. The phenomenon of carohypnosis was excoriated by some analysts at the time, but its influence would only grow during the Cold War. Truman had no difficulty accepting Acheson's and McVeigh's postulates that the Caucasus and Eastern Mediterranean were gateways to rapid Soviet world domination. Kennan, however, was deeply disturbed by what he saw as a turn toward naive and simplistic geostrategic thinking in the White House. He thought McVeigh's thesis was nonsense. The Middle East, with its patriarchal system, was not amenable to Soviet control. Many countries, even China, he stressed, could fall prey to totalitarian domination without any tragic consequences for world peace. The father, witting or otherwise of what was to become a doctrine of containing Soviet expansion, Kennan was nonetheless critical of what he saw as a dangerous American impulse to see universal formulae or doctrines in which to clothe and justify particular actions. But it was too late to try to change the president's thinking. Truman would tell his daughter Margaret that he had been worn to a frazzle by this terrible decision to make the speech. "I knew that George Washington's spirit would be invoked against me," he later reflected. Permanent entanglement in foreign rivalries was not something an American president undertook lightly. But I was convinced that the policy I was about to proclaim was indeed as much required by the conditions of my day as was Washington's by the situation in his era. Somberly clad in dark suit and dark tie, Truman strode into the packed House chamber just after 1 p.m. on March 12, 1947. Acheson sat in the front row, perfectly tailored, stiff and straight as if at a memorial service, hands folded in his lap. The mood was palpably solemn as Truman opened a black folder and began his address. Speaking for 19 minutes, clearly, slowly, with a measured forcefulness, he laid out a sweeping new doctrine of American global engagement. Each principle was introduced with the biblically inspired, "I believe," a contrivance of Clifford and Elsie's to connect the president to his upbringing in Missouri. "I believe it must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures," Truman declared. "This support should come, first and foremost, in the form of economic and financial aid, this being essential to economic stability and orderly political processes." The assertion greatly elevated the role of economic intervention in the American diplomatic arsenal. Truman juxtaposed the $400 million he was requesting to support Greece and Turkey with the $341 billion, $3.69 trillion in today's money, the United States had spent fighting World War II, declaring the former to be an investment in world freedom and world peace. Though left unsaid, the implication was that a vastly more costly war could result if Congress rejected the assistance. The belief that massive economic assistance could achieve American objectives while obviating a costly military buildup would become the greatest misperception behind the storied aid initiative to come. The backdrop of domino theory was unmistakable. "It is necessary only to glance at a map," Truman said, "to realize that the survival and integrity of the Greek nation are of grave importance in a much wider situation. If Greece should fall under the control of an armed minority, the effect upon its neighbor, Turkey, would be immediate and serious. Confusion and disorder might well spread throughout the entire Middle East. Moreover, the disappearance of Greece as an independent state would have a profound effect upon those countries in Europe whose peoples are struggling against great difficulties to maintain their freedoms and their independence while they repair the damages of war." Greece and Turkey were not isolated centers of conflict. They were the front lines of a wider struggle to determine the political map of the post-war world. This was, Truman concluded, a serious course upon which we embark, one which he would not recommend, except that the alternative is much more serious. "For if we falter in our leadership," he warned, "we may endanger the peace of the world, and we shall surely endanger the welfare of our nation." For this reason, he was confident that the Congress would face these responsibilities squarely. The chamber, members of both parties, rose in applause. Many, however, were visibly discomforted. Truman nodded left, nodded right. A sober Acheson knew that much work remained to create an actionable program out of the speech. The reaction in the hall, he concluded dispassionately, had been a tribute to a brave man rather than unanimous acceptance of his policy. The speech would live on to become probably the most controversial that has been made by a president in the 20th century. It would be credited with stirring American intervention in Greece and Turkey, just as it would be blamed for McCarthyism and later Vietnam. "The epoch of isolation and occasional intervention is ended," declared the New York Times. "It is being replaced by an epoch of American responsibility. President Truman has called for action which will launch the United States on a new and positive foreign policy of worldwide responsibility for the maintenance of peace and order." President Truman's latest address to Congress was, beyond question, one of the most momentous congressional addresses ever made by an American chief executive, enthused Barnett Nover of the Washington Post. "President Truman's message is a corollary of the Monroe Doctrine," opined William Philip Sims in the Washington Daily News. The implications of the Truman Doctrine are as grave as any the people of the United States ever were called upon to face. The decision that Congress, acting for the American people, must now make is whether we will join issue with the already undeclared ideological war by actively assisting those countries menaced by Russian communism. The Augusta Chronicle concluded, or whether we shall continue a feeble diplomacy based on appeasement and half-hearted opposition while the totalitarian ideology of Russia nibbles away at the freedom of the peoples of the world. Despite the president's speech containing a single reference to communists, Greek ones, and no references to the Soviet Union, the American press had judged the speech consequential, even if oblique as to the precise target of the call to action. Congress, the New York Times wrote, stepped into its new task after the speech, somewhat bewildered. Senator Vandenberg, however, highlighted the broad message just after leaving the House chamber. The plain truth is that Soviet-American relationships are at the core of this whole problem. The president's message faces facts, he declared, and so must Congress. Across the ocean, the Soviet journal New Times criticized American aid to the fascist Greek and Turkish regimes, as well as Washington's aspirations to world hegemony, but did not treat the speech as new policy. New York Soviet consul Yakov Lomakin reported to Deputy Foreign Minister Andrei Vyshinsky that 70-80% of the American people are opposed to granting aid to Greece and Turkey because they feared it could lead to war between the Soviet Union and the United States. The reaction of the Soviet leadership to the speech was critical, but not alarmist. Ambassador to Washington Nikolai Novikov told Molotov that the speech showed the United States would support reactionary regimes in Europe while trying to undermine the progressive ones that had been established in the East. Molotov responded that the president is trying to intimidate us, to turn us at a stroke into obedient little boys, but we don't give a damn. He still believed that the Americans had no choice but to cooperate on the real issue that divided them, Germany. A Communist Party Central Committee analysis was even more confident, proclaiming that Truman's speech had been directed as much at London as it was Moscow. It signifies Britain's expulsion from its sphere of influence in the Mediterranean and the Near East. The Truman Doctrine, as Molotov and Stalin saw it, was a regional policy, directed at an area that was simply not a Soviet priority. There would be a time and a place to challenge it, just not now. In his encounter with Marshall in Moscow the following month, Stalin would not even mention the matter. For its part, the State Department had misapprehended the position of Greece in the hierarchy of Soviet geopolitical objectives, conflating an ally's failings, Britain's, with an opponent's strategy. It had judged Greece a vacuum in the collapsing British Imperium into which Stalin would pour arms, funds, and troops if the United States did not declare its immediate intention to do the same with greater alacrity. Yet the Soviet leader had accepted that Greece was of little strategic importance to Moscow relative to other Balkan states, and had no designs on the country at this point. Stalin had in fact remained allegiant to the infamous October 1944 percentages agreement scribbled by Churchill, according to which Britain would maintain 90% influence in post-war Greece in return for predominant Soviet influence in most of the Balkans and Eastern Europe. Shortly after the deal, former Foreign Minister Maxim Litvinov wrote a strategy memorandum assigning all of the Balkans to the Soviet security sphere, with the explicit exception of Greece and Turkey. When French leader Charles de Gaulle asked Stalin about Greece shortly after, he replied, "Ask Churchill." Despite ample scope for strategic interpretation conducive to his interests, Stalin, in Churchill's words, adhered strictly and faithfully to the agreement. During all the long weeks of fighting the communists in the streets of Athens, not one word of reproach came from Pravda or Izvestia. Stalin let his people be beat up in Greece for the sake of his larger plans, establishing control in his parts of the continent, particularly Poland and Yugoslavia, with a minimum of force and treasure. When Molotov in February 1945 proposed an amendment to the draft Yalta Declaration calling for support to be given to the political leaders of countries who were resisting the Nazis, clearly intended to legitimate Soviet backing for communist fighters in the East and the Balkans, Stalin reassured a worried Churchill. "The Prime Minister," he said, "need have no anxiety that Mr. Molotov's amendment was designed